Let's start with our motivation. And it's very helpful when we think of all sentient beings to think that they haven't always been who they are now. In other words, the appearance to us right now is something temporary, that these same sentient beings have been born in other life forms, had different personalities, different experiences, and just even thinking about one sentient being from the time they were conceived, you know, on a human being, the time they were conceived in their mother's womb, through all the stages of life until death, and how much change there is there. And so in all these continuities, or continuums, the continuum in one life, the continuum over in many lives, then there is no findable person in any of these. So there keeps on being appearances of different persons according to karma, but there is no discrete, findable, individual person there at all. When we get some sense of that, then it helps us realize that to judge other people and have opinions about them is really rather nonsensical, because there's nobody there to have the opinions about. No findable person there that's going to always have whatever characteristics our opinions are putting on them. And it also helps us to see that there is a merely labeled, merely designated sentient being that does experience happiness and suffering. That is not free of afflictions and karma. And so that helps us to have compassion for them, because we're not having compassion for some discrete sentient being with a specific personality that we either like or dislike or don't care about. It's not like that. So that helps to have compassion and really free us from our opinion factory. And so with that kind of understanding, then we'll talk a little bit about emptiness and conventional reality today. And let's do it in order to benefit all those unfindable sentient beings. So you might say, well, if they're unfindable, who are we having compassion for? They're unfindable when you look for them with ultimate analysis, trying to find out exactly what or who that sentient being is. We can't find them that way, but when we don't search and analyze, then there's the appearance, and that is what's there. And nothing more. Which is really hard to grok. Because it seems like there's really real people there. But it's very helpful, you know, when our minds get really tight and have a lot of opinions about different people, to think, you know, they haven't always been who they're appearing to be right now. And even in this one lifetime, you know, they change so much. So who in the world am I having opinions about? Who in the world am I judging? And who's doing that judging anyway? Yeah. Okay, maybe they exist by being merely designated, but I'm special, I don't. Yeah. Okay, so there's a few questions, and then also I was thinking about last week the topic of the mirror eye came up, and because we were talking about the specific eye that exists by being merely designated independence on the aggregates of a specific life, and then the general eye that is designated independence on all the specific eyes. Okay? And so then what is the mirror eye? Yeah, well, there's a mirror eye that is designated independence on the aggregates of a specific life, and there's a mirror eye that is designated independence on all the specific mirror eyes. Because the only thing that, the only self that exists is the conventionally existent self, which is the mirror eye. Yeah, so it's not like there's two people there, you know, just because there's two mirror eyes or just because there's a specific eye and a general eye, it doesn't mean that you're two people. Yeah, because the general eye is imputed independence on all these, the collection of the specific eyes. So they're one nature. Okay? But, you know, this thing that we got into last week about, you know, what carries the karma, this has been a topic of discussion for centuries in all the different Buddhist schools. You know, how do you talk about no self or selflessness and still establish that there's the continuity of karma, and that, you know, the person who created the karma is the person who experiences the karma. So how do you establish that without there being a permanent, monolithic, independent person? You know, so you can see why, you know, the idea of such a kind of person evolved in human history, you know, and why it's an acquired, holding it as an acquired affliction. Because when you start thinking about, you know, what carries the karma, then, you know, it just feels like, well, yeah, there's got to be somebody there that doesn't change. Yeah, because if there was change, then one person created the karma and another person experiences it. And that can't be. But that argument works in terms of inherent existence, but it doesn't work in terms of nominal existence. Okay, so if the I were inherently existent, then, yeah, we'd have a really big problem establishing how the karma got carried. Yeah, because an inherently existent person is totally self-enclosed. It doesn't depend on causes. It doesn't produce effects. It doesn't change in any way due to the influence of anything else, because it just exists there independent on its own, which is how things appear to us to be. Yeah, so if they really existed that way, then they'd have to either be completely, you know, identical with their parts or with the aggregates, if we're looking for the I, or they'd have to be totally separate. Yeah, because if things being one nature means they depend on each other, that they influence each other, but something that exists inherently can't depend on anything else. It can't influence anything else or be influenced by anything else because it's independent. So independent means independent existence. You know, the deeper meaning of it means inherent existence. Yeah, the superficial meaning means it can mean either independent of causes and conditions or independent of parts. Okay, so then I got this lovely email printed out in font. What size font is this? 8? 9? Got it all on one page. Okay. So, it says, 2 weeks ago in the Gumchen Lamrim, you taught in the causal chain of how suffering comes from ignorance. So ignorance brings distorted attention, which brings afflictions, which brings karma, which brings dukkha. Okay? And then they said, so you said in the system of the 12 links, the end result of karma ripening as dukkha could be seen in aging and death. Yeah? Okay. So, comparing the two causal chains, the first one being what I set out about ignorance, distorted attention, afflictions, karma, suffering, and then the other chain with the 12 links, I was left with a few questions. Okay, so first, where is distorted attention in the 12 links? Is it subsumed under ignorance? Yes. Okay, so the link of ignorance, the first link, ignorance, is the ignorance that grasps at true existence. If you create negative, if what we're creating is negative karma, the second link, then you also have with it the ignorance of inherent existence is going to bring also the ignorance of cause and effect. And it can also, in the case of, again, if we're going to be creating negative karma, it can bring the distorted attention that sees the impermanent as permanent, the foul as beautiful, the what lacks a self as having a self, and what's the other one?
Dukkha.
Yeah, and what is by nature dukkha as happiness. Okay, so those are all distorted attentions or distorted conceptions. So you can kind of put them all under ignorance. They kind of fall in between ignorance and karma, yeah? Because I asked the same question, and so it was mostly, most people put them under ignorance. I guess some people might put that kind of thing under karma. So where are the afflictions, aside from craving and clinging, in the 12 links? Well, first of all, ignorance is the affliction. And then, you know, after you have the distorted attention, then you're going to get, in the case when you're creating negative karma, you're going to get the afflictions before the second link. And so that's all part of the first link. Okay? Because the progression goes straight from ignorance to karma. Are the rest of the afflictions subsumed under ignorance too, as that is the base from which they arise? So basically, yes, they belong there. Okay? Now, of course, if you're creating positive karma, you're still going to have the grasping at inherent existence. But that's not going to produce, you're not going to have afflictions in there. You may still have some distorted attention in there, but you're not necessarily going to have the afflictions. And then you go to karma. So that's probably why there's no separate link of afflictions, because in the case of creating virtuous karma that causes rebirth and samsara, you know, aside from the self-grasping ignorance, that basic affliction, there isn't going to be another one. Okay. Then in the system of the 12 links, you can cut the ripening of karma at contact and at feeling. Wrong. You can't not cut it at contact. Yeah, there's two places where it can be cut. One is feeling, where you feel and then you prevent craving and clinging from the arising. The other is by doing away with ignorance. Okay, you don't break it at contact. Yeah, because kind of as soon as there's contact, there's feeling, you know. like automatically. Okay. So can you cut it at distorted attention? I would say if there's ignorance, you're going to get distorted attention following pretty quickly after that. And then if afflictions, you know, following right after that, which is why they say you got to cut the root of, which is ignorance. Yeah. Because kind of by the, you know, when, as soon as ignorance is there, it's like boom, 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 boom. You know, it all happens. Okay. Okay, so by recognizing the misconceptions you have about a person or an object, so even if the afflictions arise, you're not necessarily going to act upon them. Yeah, so an affliction may arise, and you may not act about on it, you know, so you may not create physical and verbal karma. You may create mental karma if an affliction arose, okay? And even if it's not strong enough to actually be a mental karma and you don't act on it, okay, that doesn't mean you've broken the chain. It just means you haven't started another set of 12 links, okay? Because breaking the chain means you know, it's broken, it can't produce, you know, suffering anymore. But if we have an affliction and we don't act on it, then, you know, that's just either we're creating mental karma and starting a set of 12 links like that if it's very strong, or we don't, it's not strong enough to produce the second link, in which case we just aren't starting another set of 12 links. Okay, is that clear to everybody? Okay. Yeah, so it's good not to act on our afflictions when they arise. Yeah. Would you say that breaking down distorted attention is a key focus of the four establishments of mindfulness? I would say yes, that's one of the important things. Because when you read it, they take the four distorted conceptions or four distorted attentions, and they're correlated with the four objects of mindfulness. So with mindfulness of the body, what you're really trying to break down is the distorted conception that what is foul is pure. With mindfulness of feeling, you're breaking down the distorted conception that thinks that what is in the nature of dukkha is actually happiness. With mindfulness of mind, you're breaking down the distorted conception that thinks what is impermanent is actually permanent. And with mindfulness of phenomena, you're breaking down the distorted conception that thinks that don't have a self actually have one. Yeah, so they are kind of lined up. They're correlated in that way, but that doesn't mean that when you meditate on one specific thing, you only come to that specific, you only refute that specific distorted conception. You can come to see the insanity of all of the other three as well. Okay? So lots of times when they make correlations between things, we think, you know, it's like exactly one-to-one and nothing ever overlaps. Like when we hear on the first ground, bodhisattvas perfect generosity, then we think, oh, they only practice generosity on the first ground. They don't practice it on the second ground or third ground. They didn't practice it before they attained the first ground. You know, we think, oh, there's a correlation. That's the only time. No. Okay. So correlations are interesting things, but don't get your mind that likes to build boxes too revved up. Okay. About the four-point analysis, in looking at how the eye appears to exist, both looking back on a situation where I receive negative feedback and also my ongoing reactivity to it, I see that there appeared to be this solid me that was being blamed, criticized, harmed, and so forth. But when I would move on to the second and third point, my mind resisted because there was this thought, yeah, there's a solid me, but there's also the me that changes. Yeah. So of course I change. I'm not just that static solid me in that moment of being yelled at. So I'm not only thinking of myself in that solid way. So how are these two options of the second point relevant? Well, the second point is seeing that if the I was inherently existent, then it's either got to be identical to the aggregates or separate from the aggregates. So I'm not understanding what your question is regarding that second point and what your question is.
I guess my point was that I couldn't get myself to a point where I could say that there's only those two options.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So okay. I could see that that there was this solid me that was there, but my mom goes, yeah, but I know that I'm not just that.
Yeah.
Well, and so then I couldn't get myself to the point where I could see that there's just those two options.
Okay.
Okay.
Because you say, okay, well, yeah, there is a me that changes, and there is a me that's really kind. So the me that's really kind wasn't the one that was getting scolded.
It was more my logical mind coming in going, yeah, but I know that I change. I know that I'm not just that solid thing.
You know up here that you change. Okay. Do you know in here that you change? Or is there this idea, you know? And what I find is when we're refuting some of the lower school, the non-Buddhist schools, you know, when Geshe Thapke was here and he was going through them, then one of them posits the kind of thing, the person that is basically permanent but sometimes impermanent. You know, overall is permanent but also impermanent, because they said there's got to be a soul or a self that goes on. But you can see in the course of one life, like you just said, you know, you're not one solid person. You change all the time. Okay? So this is exactly how our mind works. It's like, yeah, I change. But that's only an idea, because underneath it all, there's this feeling of this really solid me. Yeah, that's you know, independent, and it's not changing. Okay? So, yeah, we have to be careful of some of our, you know, when you say your conceptual mind, your intellectual mind starts thinking like that, then you say to yourself, is that actually true? You know, I'm thinking, oh, there's the solid me, and then there's the me that's changing. Can there exist both of those at the same time in relationship to the same set of aggregates? No. You know, it's impossible for that to exist. Our mind likes to believe something like that, and it feels right, but because we believe it and because it feels right, those are not the reasons to prove the existence of something. Okay? But this is, you know, how we usually do it. Are you getting what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, so, you know, lots of times it's the same with the mindfulness of the body. Oh, yes, I can see, you know, my body is just a bag of, you know, vegetable glue, and it's kind of disgusting. But boy, that guy over there is so good looking. You know, we do that back to back. Yeah? This shows how, you know, what ignorance means, isn't it? That we can even say the right thing Yeah, but we don't really get it because our own experience is the very next moment. We're grasping at the opposite of what we said. Yeah? Or, you know, oh yeah, somebody just gave me this new watch, you know, it's so beautiful, it's so great. I know it's impermanent, it's going to break. And then it just cracked, you know, or the cat chewed it in half, or the dog ate it. What? What happened? Huh? That wasn't supposed to happen. But, you know, 10 seconds before we said, oh yeah, I know it's impermanent, it's going to change. Yeah, I know it's dependent on parts, but when the parts are lying all over the table, we freak out. Yeah, it's not supposed to depend on parts. It's one whole watch that's always going to be one thing there that's never going to change, you know? Okay, so, you know, our mind is totally irrational. I mean, it's really crazy. The more you start looking, the crazier you see, you know. We're all really, you know, and then you wonder, my goodness, how did the Buddhas manage it, you know? I mean, bodhisattvas, what kind of compassion do they have to put up with people like us who are so convinced we're right when we're wrong? You know, and we're wrong on so many levels, you know. Yeah, on so many different, I mean, in one emotion that we have, we're wrong on so many different levels, and we think we're totally right. And I mean, what kind of fortitude do the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas have to put up with that? Yeah, when they try and teach us things, get it? And the next moment, we're acting totally in the opposite way. Yeah, they say it's like you wash your puppy and as soon as it jumps out, it goes rolls in some mud. You know, Okay. But really, when you think about it, it's like, it makes you think, wow, I want to be a bodhisattva. I'm going to have to put up with that. Then you realize, but I am the that. I am the that the bodhisattvas have to put up with. Oh, my God, you know. Yeah, okay. So I think that question's taken care of. Okay, so how to see the relevance of the second point that there are only two options for an inherently existent self? How to convince myself of clearly seeing, to see clearly, look, if you really look at how you hold yourself to exist, you're thinking in terms of inherent existence. You know, I mean, the whole key of to the first thing is to become aware of how we perceive things, how we hold things to exist. And we're usually seldom aware of, you know, we don't stop to really reflect on that. Yeah, I mean, we'll do some analysis. You know, we got mad at somebody and, okay, you know, what's the reason for my anger? Is it, you know, valid? We'll do that kind of analysis. But do we ever stop and think, how is the I appearing to me? How am I holding myself to exist at that moment? No? Yeah. So then when we do the four-point analysis and we're told, you know, think of an inherently existent I, you know, get the idea clear in your mind, you know, then we invent something. Yeah. 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 Jhāngyā Rōpa Dorje said he has this beautiful text, what is it? Something seeing the mother. I forget the, something with mother in it. But, and he's saying that when we do the refutation, it's like we think of, you know, there's the person, and then inherent existence is a hat on their head, and we're just taking the hat off. But we're leaving the whole person there. And so we think we're refuting inherent existence, but we're still seeing the person as inherently existent. Yeah. So nothing's really changed. Our refutation hasn't made any effect on our mind. And that's the usual thing. I mean, I know for myself, and I hear so many other people say it, is, oh, I do the four-point analysis, but it doesn't change my mind. Kind of, well, so what? So what? I'm not one with my body. I'm not different from my body. I'm not one with my mind. I'm not different. How? So what? Yeah, I can see that. That's true. So? Yeah, haven't I realized emptiness then? Yeah, shouldn't I already be an Arya? Yeah. So this is because, you know, we know the words and we can put them together right, but we have no idea what inherent existence looks like. You know, and what it looks like is what we're seeing and what we're holding on to all day long, but we're not realizing, we don't understand how things appear to us and how we're grasping them. We just, it's like, yeah, this is how things exist. I mean, look around this room. Yeah, aren't you seeing reality? And what is appearing to you real? And when you look at each person here, isn't there a real person? And aren't you a real person? Yeah. So what's this inherent existence stuff that we're supposed to be negating? Yeah. Oh, it's they appear solid and concrete. Yeah. Yeah. We say it, but what does that mean? Yeah. We don't really, we have a really hard time identifying that in our experience. Yeah. So that's the difficulty in the four-point analysis, is that first point. Yeah, they say if you can understand the first one, the other three aren't so difficult. But the first one's hard. It is hard, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, because normally, you know, you look around, oh, what's wrong with what I'm seeing? Yeah, it works. Yeah. I know that there's a staircase there and I can walk up it. What are you talking about? My perception of the staircase is distorted. I know it's a staircase and I know how to use it and it functions that way. So what's wrong with the way I'm perceiving things? Yeah. And this guy over here, you know, he's cheating me. Yeah. Now, isn't it? China's cheating us. Yeah. That's the new thing. Yeah, in trade, yeah, you know, yeah, so, you know, and Russia's spying on us, and, you know, and I don't know what else is going on. Okay, but, you know, so, yeah, this is total reality. I'm seeing it. I know that person's trying to harm me, yeah, and I know the way to deal with it is to, you know,
sorry.
Yeah. So, yeah, and when I beat him up and when I kill him, then he stops bothering me. So what's wrong with the way I'm perceiving things? It works. Yeah. So then we say, yeah, then what's all this stuff about non-inherent existence? Yeah, the way I see things work. Yeah. My anger is right. My anger is telling me something is wrong and I need to follow it because otherwise people are going to walk all over me. You know, I don't want them to walk all over me. So it's good. I need to get angry. And I need to be greedy. Because if I don't look out for myself, who's going to look out for me? And I need to take more than my share because I might lack something at some point. So I need, you know, some reservoir to fall back on. I need a safety net. So I should take more than my share. So what's wrong with the way I see things? It works, doesn't it? Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't this what we think?
Content to constantly live with suffering.
Huh?
If you're content to constantly live with suffering, it works.
But yes, we have suffering, but suffering has nothing to do with the way I see things. Suffering is caused by external factors. You know, China's treating us in trade. Russia's spying on us. You know, they think they could, that Russia could even, turn off our electric grid if they wanted to. They've hacked so far into. Yeah. But that they could, kind of affect what's going on at nuclear plants and the electric grid and water and things like, if they wanted to. That's how far they've hacked. Yeah, so you see, all of our problems, they come from outside. We're sweet, innocent, kind, wonderful people. And those Russians, of course, they're looking, see, those Americans. Well, now everybody's looking and going, those Americans. So everybody, nobody questions the way things appear to them. And, we don't link our experience of suffering to the way things appear to us. Yeah. I mean, if somebody criticizes me and hurts my feelings, it's all their fault. I have no responsibility. None. Zero. They harmed me. And I did nothing to deserve that. And they don't understand me. And that's why they're harming me. And so that's why they're stupid. And that's why they're worthy of being clunked. Isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Just ask Karuna. Except she's sleeping. But yeah, this is how we see things. So, one of the first things that, one of the most difficult things in Dharma practice, but is the key to the rest that follows, is to be okay with being wrong and to recognize that there's a relationship between our experiences and what goes on in our mind and how we perceive things and how we conceive things. And if we can't understand that, then Dharma just seems to be like a ton of bricks that, is weighing on us and blaming us for things that we didn't do and, telling us we're going to hell. Yeah, so it's all the Dharma's fault. Yeah, so better avoid the Dharma. Yeah, I mean, this is the world, isn't it? The world and how people think and how we think.
This reminds me, it's a very silly example, but it's recent and it's very vivid in my mind still. Reminds me of all the suffering I underwent thinking there was a mountain lion from here to the community room. In fact, there was no mountain lion up there. It was just in my mind. And I was so terrified.
Yeah.
And scared to walk in the dark from here to there, and there was no reason to. I was just making it up myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And all the other suffering you undergo is similarly being made up by the mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This one was just more in me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Identify.
Right.
It was just so outlandish.
Right. Yeah.
But the other ones were common. They're hard to see.
They're harder to see, yeah, but this one was, yeah. Oh, there's a mountain lion just outside there under the willow tree. He's waiting for me.
Big, mean eyes.
Yeah.
I wanted to share a recent example too, but as in once you see the total illogic of the mind, that's when it helps us to catch it, right? So we were in Taiwan, and then I forgot to put water out for your seat and all that, and I was so jet lagged. And when we went back, then you said something like, oh, you forgot to put water there. So-and-so remembers such details very well. And my next thought immediately was, my mother never compared us as children. It's like, there's no logic, right? But it, the eye, when I look back, the eye was so solid. It was like, I got a sense of that concreteness, you know what I mean? Like the whole continuum got compressed and was like, and then my next thought was, I'm buying an air ticket home. And then I lost sleep that night, you know, that whole night. I was like, oh, I'm such a failure. It's like over a cup of water. And then the next morning I told you, wow, I just tortured myself. That's crazy. But, you know, just the mind, there's the little bit of mind that can see, okay, this is not true. And the other piece that's like, it's just really nuts.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And how forgetting a glass of water, you know, the real meaning of that was that you're a total worthless person. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the solution was you buy an air ticket.
Yeah.
Home. Yes. Where's home?
Here.
Where they're going to say, what in the world did you do? You left her in Taiwan without a glass of water?
It's like amazing. You can see the total illogic of your mind.
Yeah.
And then you just have to sit. And then there's a part that believes it. And the two parts like to fight with each other.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we dig in our heels. I'm right. Yeah. Okay. So maybe we got through that point too. I don't know. Okay. I am thinking that my job is through study and much more meditation to see clearly what this misconception of inherent existence looks like in my own mind. I think my resistance is that deep down, I'm not willing to acknowledge I'm grasping onto inherent existence. That's very true, and you don't know what the inherent existence is that you're grasping onto. So it's not that you just aren't acknowledging you grasp inherent existence. You don't even realize you're doing it because you don't know what grasping an inherent existence means. Yeah. So there we are. You know, and they say we have a precious human life. Yeah. Yeah. How did we ever get a precious human life if our minds are so crazy? Yeah.
How fortunate we are that we're beginning to see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I mean, like, just really getting used to being wrong. You know, there I am, wrong again. And to find out that being wrong is actually freedom. Because if things existed the way they appeared to us, then there would be no way to ever work with them and remedy the situation. If what we perceive and what we conceive of actually exists that way, then there's no way to attain awakening because there's no way that something that is inherently polluted, like us, can become a Buddha if it's fixed in time and space and can't be influenced by anything else. So you know, when you start to see that, then, oh, I'm wrong. Oh, shrew, that's good. Yeah? Because if I'm right, then... Yeah? Yeah? So, yeah, like if I'm right and there really is a mountain lion there, yeah, then I'm in big trouble. And if I'm right and, you know, this intolerable person is comparing me with somebody else and broke my mother's first rule, which was never to compare her children, although she did anyway. yeah, then, yeah. Okay? So let's go back to the text, huh? Okay, so we're on the outline. Said it's called establishing the lack of an intrinsic nature of mine.
Yeah.
Okay. So it says, when you investigate in this way, in other words, as above, where we did the four-point analysis, because you cannot find a self in aggregates that are inherently one or inherently distinct, the self does not exist inherently. Okay? So if it inherent existence, there would only be those two choices. Yeah. If it were conventionally existent, you have many more than two choices. Yeah? Because conventionally existent things depend on other stuff. Yeah. But if they were independent, then you only have those two choices. So this is something really to think about. Because it sounds good, but we don't quite get it. Because, again, we're not really understanding what inherent existence is. But it's hard to recognize it. Okay, so because you cannot find a self in aggregates that are inherently one or distinct, the self does not exist inherently. Since it is not inherently existent, what is mine does not exist inherently either. Okay, so mine is what makes something mine. Okay, mine is a person. So it's still got to be, you're negating the self of persons. It's not a self of phenomena. Okay, it is the same as the child of a barren woman not having eyes. Okay? There's no child of the barren woman, so you can't talk about it, not, you know, it having eyes. So in the same way, there's no inherently existent person, so you can't talk about there being an inherently existent mind. Okay? This selfless mode of existence applies also to a non-inherently existent mind, because that's the only mind that exists. Using this reasoning that examines whether the basis of imputation and the imputed object are inherently one or distinct, anyone can engage in the analysis of all knowable entities and realize the two truths. How marvelous. Okay, so the reason that examines whether the basis of imputation and the imputed object are inherently one or distinct. So the basis of imputation is usually the parts that make something up. Okay, so we have the telephone. So on the basis of all the parts assembled in a particular way, then we say telephone. Okay, so telephone is the designated object or the imputed object. And the basis of designation is this thing here. Yeah, all the parts that are put together in a particular order. If the parts were put together in a different order, you could not look at it and call it a telephone. Okay? So it becomes real clear when you think about it that how they say, what is it, the sum of the whole, the sum of the parts is bigger than the whole. And that's really true. And I like thinking about the example of a cake. Okay? Because if you're making a cake, if you put, when you're cooking, if you put all the different things out there on the table before you start doing anything, there's absolutely no cake there. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to take a mouthful of flour and say, wow, this cake is great. On your, or you're not going to take, you know, a spoonful of vanilla or, you know, a quarter cup of cocoa raw or, you know, any of these things and say, wow, this cake is delicious. There's totally no cake there. You have to look at it and really, you know, look at all those things. And there is absolutely no cake. Forget it. Okay. And then it's interesting because when you put all the ingredients together and stir them up, yeah, it looks completely different than when they were all separate. But you still don't have a cake. But it looks, just when you took the parts and you put them together, you know, that raw batter doesn't look anything like any of the ingredients. Yeah. If you didn't know that you could mix those ingredients together and that's what the batter looked like, if you didn't know that and you just saw ingredients and then you saw batter, you wouldn't think that mixing these together would lead to that because they look so totally different. Yeah. And then what's really weird is you take that gooey stuff, yeah, that's usually kind of a tan color, a light brown color. You put it in an oven, and when it comes out, it smells different. It's a different color, yeah. The texture is totally different, and the taste is different. So, like, everything about it, how it looks, how it smells, how it tastes, how it feels, the cooked cake is totally different from the batter. So again, if you didn't know that you could put that gooey stuff in an oven and do something, and you just saw gooey stuff and you saw a cake, you wouldn't think that there was any relationship between them. Yeah. But in dependence on all those things being put together, and not just put together, but to put together in a certain way, and then a certain thing done to that, independent on that whole causal process, then you can say there's a cake. Yeah. And when you look at it, you see cake. There's cake appearing from its own side. Isn't there? When you look at it, you know, there's cake. It's the cake is appearing from out there into you. Yeah? It looks like an object totally different from my mind. You know? And it's totally different than all the ingredients. And it's totally different from the batter. And it's just there, and it's cake. Yeah? And I want some because it has happiness inside of it. Yeah. So somewhere, if I cut that cake open, there's going to be happiness. There's going to be pleasure. Yeah, that's the way it appears to us.
So that's exactly an example of what you were saying earlier, like when you were saying if it's inherently existent, there's just two choices, but if things are dependent, there are many choices. So here you're looking at these, the basis of designation, these ingredients, mm-hmm. and there's many choices about how they could be, essentially. Yeah. So it's exactly an example of dependency.
Yeah.
Is yeah. that right?
It fits because that, it's going to look different whether you cook it for an hour or for 10 minutes. Yeah? But it's amazing because if you look in the ingredients, no cake. In the batter, no cake. If somebody served you a plate full of batter and said this was a wonderful dessert, no, that's not going to work. So there's no cake in the batter. I mean, you look at the ingredients, no cake. You look at the batter, no cake. No cake in this batter. Then how come when it comes out of the oven, there's a cake? Yeah, it really looks like it, doesn't it? It looks like total magic that here's this cake, and it came out of nothing. It came out of a bunch of things that are non-cakes. How do you create a cake out of a combination of non-cakes? What a ridiculous thing, you know? Because when you look at it, and for sure there is a cake there. You know, independent of my mind, there is a cake. But how did it get there? Where did that cake come from? It's not in the parts. It's not in the ingredients. It's not in the batter. It's not in the oven. Where did that cake come from? Yeah. And it's just our mind giving a designation on something out there and calling it cake, and then forgetting that we were the ones that designated it cake, and instead thinking that there is the essence of cakeness out there coming into us. Yeah, we designated cake. Our conceptual mind put cake on top of that, and then we think that cake's coming from it. We forget that we're the ones that designated. Yeah. And so we get so tangled up. Yeah, so tangled up. Then the next outline is explaining the meaning of what is said to be like an illusion, okay? Because when you're doing this thing about emptiness, okay, first you meditate on emptiness and you come to the conclusion that, you know, you can't find the object that you're searching for. Okay, or you come to the conclusion that if the eye or if the cake existed as the way it appeared, it would have to be one way, this way or that way, and it's not either way, neither of those ways. So it doesn't exist in the way that it appears to me, and it doesn't exist in the way that I'm conceiving it. Okay, so that's called space-like meditation, because when you thoroughly investigate the basis of designation and you can't find the designated object anywhere in there, yeah, then it's this like, oh, you know, like I thought there was a mountain lion. Oh, there's not. Oh. No. Yeah. But it's kind of a like, oh, how could I have been so wrong?
How could I have been so silly?
Yeah. Yeah. Because what I thought was there, it's not there. There's no cake. There's no person. You know, when you look at that piece of rope that's coiled up, there is absolutely no snake there. Totally not. Yeah, when you look at the person who you're sure is an enemy, there's absolutely no enemy there. That person, that country, whatever, that group is empty of enemy-ness. It's just totally not there. Okay, so that's called space-like meditation on emptiness. Okay. Now, the thing is, so then you stay in that, you know, oh, it's not there. Okay. The thing is, yeah, if this is not a direct perceiver and you're still discovering this by means of conceptual processes, then there's the danger to go, oh, nothing exists. There's no cake in that there, therefore there's no cake at all. Okay? So this is the problem that happens when you're still on the inferential state. Yeah? And that's where you get the story of the monk who grabs his donka. You know, that's where he was. He wasn't having a direct perceiver of emptiness. When you have a direct perceiver, you're cool with it. Okay? It's when you have the inference that you're going, wait a minute! Yeah? I know there's a cake there. I just had a piece. Okay? So that's the space-like. Then when you come out of your meditation, yeah, then it's called the illusion-like meditation on emptiness, okay? So first is the space-like meditation on emptiness, and then it's the illusion-like, okay? So space-like because you're not finding what you get. Illusion-like is you come out of your meditation, and it's like, wow, I was so convinced there was no cake there, totally convinced there's no cake. But look, there's a cake. I'm seeing it with my eyes. Yeah? But wait a minute. How can I see that cake with my eyes if there's no cake there? Okay. And that, then you see, oh, the cake is like an illusion. It appears to be real, but it doesn't actually exist that way. So the cake appears to be inherently existent, but it doesn't exist that way. But it not being inherently existent does not mean it's totally non-existent. It just means it doesn't exist the way it appears to me. Okay? Yeah, so it's like, I don't know if there was a log or something you thought that was the mountain lion?
No, it was just whatever shadow of a branch of a bush of a
okay,
thing,
so
or
that
movement or the wind, you know.
Yeah, okay. So dependent on this shadow, you know, with the wind, then, you know, okay, so once you realized there's no mountain lion, yeah, but there was still the shadow.
Yeah, there was still the darkness and the shadow and the wind and everything else.
Yeah.
There's no mountain lion.
Okay, but there's no mountain. But there were still all those other things. So, the mountain lion wasn't there, but that doesn't mean that there was nothing there. Okay, there was something there, but what was there was not a mountain lion.
Right. Your mountain lion is only mine.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is where, you know, it's a very good example, actually. And it's kind of like when we look in the mirror, you know, you look in the mirror and, you know, there I am in the mirror. It looks exactly like me. It must be me. And you see sometimes people look in the mirror, and if they're really mad at themselves, they hit the mirror. Yeah? I remember watching one scene in that movie, A Beautiful Mind, you know? And his wife got so fed up and just broke the mirror. But for him too, look. Yeah, he thought in that movie, I seldom watch movies, but, you know, it's about a guy who was schizophrenic, yeah, who was seeing things and people who were not there, but they appeared so vivid and real to him that he was interacting with them and doing all this stuff. And, you know, he was just convinced there were other people who were there. And once he realized that he had this problem, he still had those appearances. And he would then sometimes ask somebody next to him, I see somebody there. Is there a person there, or is that just my disease, you know, making me see somebody there? Yeah. So it's kind of the same thing with a face in the mirror. We look at it, and it's like there's a person in the mirror. And if you're a kitty or you're a baby, you want to play with the kitten or the baby in the mirror. You have a playmate. Yeah. You go like this, and it doesn't feel like it's supposed to.
Or the turkey's at the window.
Yeah, the turkey's at the window. Yeah. Okay, another good example. Or just looking at a screen, you know. You look at a TV screen or a computer screen, and, you know, there's real people there. Yeah, and things happen on the screen. In some situations you laugh, in some situations you cry. It looks like there's, you know, it's so vivid that there's real people in that screen. Yeah. Is there a person in their mirror? Are there people in the screen? No, there aren't. But does that mean that there's nothing there? No, there's the appearance of a person, and that appearance of the person, like in the mirror, is due to the accumulation of different causes. The presence of the mirror, the presence of a person who's standing in a certain relationship to the mirror, the presence of light. Yeah, so you have to have all these different causes and conditions together, and then it looks like there's a person in the mirror, but there's no person in the mirror. But there's the appearance of a person in the mirror. And that appearance still works, because you can look at the person in the mirror, you know, and you can use it, you know, to pop your zits and to shave your head. You know, when you want to shave your head, it's nice to have a person in the mirror. You can see all the places where you missed. Yeah, it's good that there's a reflection in the mirror. Otherwise, you know, you shave your head and you're going to look like I don't know what with all these little things sticking out. Okay, so there's no person there, but there's an appearance, and that appearance functions, and we can use it. Yeah, it functions as a reflection. It does not function as a person. Okay, so the same way, you know, like there's the appearance of inherently existent people, and those appearances function as nominally existent people, but they don't function as inherently existent people. But our problem is we can't tell the difference between the two of them. Yeah, because we don't really know what inherent existence looks like. Yeah. And because what appears to us is a mixture of the nominally existent person and the inherently existent one, and they're completely mixed up together, and we can't separate them. Okay. So, time, questions? Yeah.
Two questions. But so how is it that you can say that we designate correctly a person on the mirror eye or the conventional self when we never actually see it?
Yeah. So how can we say that it's a correct designation to say, you know, there's Venerable Losang or there's Venerable Tarp or whatever? It's simply because it's a group of people agree on that designation. and we agree on the definition of what that term means, and it can function according to the definition that we've agreed upon. Yeah?
You don't have to see the focal object.
No, you can't see it.
You can see the face.
Yeah.
You see what you're saying.
Yeah, well, it's like when to see that there's a person there, you don't see a person. You see a body or part of a body, or you hear a voice, or if you're clairvoyant, you read a mind, okay? But you don't see a person anywhere in all of that, yeah? And similarly, you know, when we look at the gong, we don't see the whole gong. We just, you know, I'm looking at it, I'm seeing this side, and on the basis of this side, I'm saying there's a gong. And you agree with me that there's a gong, but what you're seeing is not what I'm seeing, because you're on the other side seeing here.
So could you say that we're seeing the basis of designation?
Well, what each of us are seeing, we're only seeing part. I'm seeing one part of the basis of designation. You're seeing the other part. But we're both designating it gong. And we both agree that gongs make noise when you hit them. And you can use them to indicate the noise to indicate something. And so, you know, so then it functions as a gong. And it's okay to call it a gong. Even though what you're seeing and what I'm seeing are different, because we're seeing opposite sides of it. Yeah? Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? We're not even seeing. Yeah, when we're seeing something, we're not seeing the whole basis of designation.
Mm-hmm. You mm-hmm. talked about this, seeing the mother, that text.
Oh, yeah.
Who's the author?
Chöngyo Rinpoche Dorje. I have the text. If you remind me, I can email it.
So, like with the gong, we're not only imputing inherent existence on the basis of designation. We're also imputing part of the basis of designation that we can't see. Like you're imputing that there's a side.
No,
on
we're
this
imputing
side.
Gong.
Right, but you're also you're assuming that there's another side to it, like
yeah.
a side you can see.
Right.
So we're kind of imputing
right.
that too.
Right. No, we're just assuming that.
Okay.
Yeah, we're assuming that. And that's why sometimes the designations we give to things are incorrect, because we're only seeing one part of the basis of designation, and we're assuming the other part's there, and it's not. Yeah? So, but it's fair to designate by only seeing part of the basis of designation and saying, you know, I saw the gong. And then if it turns out later that, you know, actually this whole side wasn't there or something, then you label it something else and you say, oh, I was fooled. Okay. Or it's like, what would be, oh, you know, you walk outside and you see something, you say, there's the car. Yeah. Now, maybe you're just seeing the outside, but actually there's no engine in it. There's no pistons. There's no, you know, nothing that makes it work. There's no seats. There's nothing in there. You're just seeing the outside, you know. And so you're assuming there's an inside. And in normal circumstances, there would be one. So you say there's a car. Yeah. But then when you sit down to try and get in the car and drive it, you realize, oh, it looks like a car, but it's not a real car because it doesn't function as a car. So that's what I mean. Like with things that are nominally designated that are not inherently existent, there's so much wiggle room in terms of what something can be, what you call it, you know. Yeah, because you can call this thing a table, you can call it a desk, you could call it a bench. Yeah, and you can call it all these different things. Yeah, and none of the things are the same thing. even though the basis of designation is the same. Yeah. And so that's why, like, you know, imputed existence, nominal existence is messy. Yeah. Because there's a bench and a table and a desk. All here. Yeah. But if this were inherently a desk, you couldn't have a bench and a table also. Yeah, because it would just be a desk. Which is why sometimes, you know, somebody is using something, somebody takes something and uses it for a purpose that we've never considered it being used for, or we don't think is a good purpose, and we freak out. You know, how can you use? You know, what's a good example?
It's a cause of much affliction at home.
Wait, what?
It's a cause of much affliction in the community.
Yeah, what's a good example?
Partner that you smoke—it's driving me crazy.
I had a partner that used to use the faucet on a tub as like a handrail to get up out of the tub. And I was always like, that faucet is so frail, and the plumbing behind it is good. They're going to have to pull out the wall to fix it. I was always like, it's not our handrail.
Yeah, it's not a handrail. Yeah. But see, that's because things conventionally exist. So you can look at them in different ways. They can have a variety of designations. They can be used for a variety of functions. But if things were inherently existent, none of that could happen. Everything would be neat and tidy, just like we want it to be. And also, it would be non-existent. Yeah? Okay, so anything else?
It's not so much a question as much, but if you could speak a bit more about how the conventional I and the inherently existent I are completely intertwined, like you said.
Well, you put milk and water together. When you look at it, can you see the milk? Can you see the water as separate? So it's like that. Yeah. And we hear, it's milk and water together. No, it's just one thing. Yeah. We can't differentiate.